Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to A Fine Time for Healing, a sanctuary for your emotional well-being. Your host is Randy Fine, author of the memoir Finally, and the inspirational self-help book Awaken from Life. Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in and listening to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk radio show host, Randy Fine. Today, we are going to be talking about the disease alcoholism and the trail of tragedy it leaves behind. The National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism reports that nearly 88,000 people die from alcohol-related causes annually, making it the third leading preventable cause of death in the United States. An article published by the Karen Institute states that approximately 53% of adults in the United States have reported that one or more of their close relatives has a drinking problem. Research shows the genes are responsible for about half of the risk for alcoholism, but that genes alone do not determine whether someone will become an alcoholic. Environmental factors, as well as gene and environment interactions, account for the remainder of the risk. Facts are facts, and they are alarming. But the real tragedy of alcoholism lies in the broken-hearted families it affects, families that feel ashamed, confused, and disappointed, families who don't know how to help their loved ones who have this disease, children who grow up in alcoholic homes and suffer for the rest of their lives, husbands, wives, mothers, and fathers who are left to pick up the pieces. My special guest today, Alberta Sequeira, has lived this tragedy from beginning to end, not once, but twice. She suffered through life with an alcoholic husband while trying to raise two young daughters. He died from his disease at the young age of 45. And if that wasn't torturous enough, her youngest daughter followed in the footsteps of her father and died at 39. Alberta felt helpless against the hold alcoholism had against her loved ones and is on a mission to help other families who are dealing with the same thing. She is a four-time award-winning author and an awareness coach on substance abuse for private and public events. She is the producer, director, and co-host to the NBTV 95 cable TV station out of New Bedford, Massachusetts. She has written three memoirs, and I have read all three from cover to cover. She's written A Spiritual Renewal. I did not read that one. That one is not about alcoholism, but I have read Someone Stop This Merry-Go-Round and its sequel, Please God Not To. And she is also author of the book that I have read, What Is and Isn't Working for the Alcoholic and Addict, which includes personal stories by 34 alcoholics and drug users from all walks of life. Today, Alberta is here to tell us her story and give us some insight into what she has learned amidst all these tragedies. So now let's give a warm welcome to Alberta Sequeira. Good morning, Alberta.
Good morning, Randy. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Welcome to A Fine Time for Healing, and thank you so much for being my guest today. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Yes. Your stories are absolutely amazing. As I said, I read the three books about alcoholism from cover to cover, and I was totally taken in by them. You wrote them with such transparency, honesty, and tenderness, and love. I lost a loved one, as I just told you, I lost a loved one to drug addiction and could identify so much with what you went through. So why don't you tell us your story, Alberta?
My story started as a young girl, I'd say 18 years old. Even younger than that, I was between 16 and 17 when I met a great guy. It was my first true love. It wasn't the man that I had married. But, you know, not comparing dating a lot of men, I guess I took his love really for granted, thinking that's how all men feel about you. But he was in the Navy, and he went away for a while, and sometimes those gaps are not healthy. And I had met my future husband, Richie, through a friend. And the first night I met him with her, he was with a buddy, and they were drinking. And I was kind of nervous with that. And I said to my girlfriend, I said, geez, I'm kind of nervous. He seemed to be drinking a lot. And she said, oh, Alberta, don't worry about it. That's what guys do. That's the macho thing. Well, we're talking back in the late 50s, early 60s. So I thought, well, maybe it was me. I came from a very close-knit family. My father was a retired one-star brigadier general in the Army. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. God bless her. She greeted us every day when we came home from school. I have four siblings. I lost one brother when he was seven from polio, but we were a very close family. I look back and I say, gosh, what a wonderful time we had growing up. So I was in a confused state with meeting this new man. I don't know what it is about women. I'm not blaming all of them. We always seem to be attracted to that bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very handsome, as I felt. And I avoided him for months. You know, he would call my girlfriend and say, gee, she wants to date you. But to make the story short, I made a mistake when I started dating him. But when he was with me, he never drank. He was a very shy, quiet boy. But he was very loving, but he wasn't outgoing. He was with his family. He was very distant, but I just accepted that was his personality. Looking back now, I'm not saying this is the way all alcoholics are, but I have read that some have this trait. They want to keep you in their world, but slowly without realizing it, we let our friends go. I even pushed aside my close relationship with my sister. So I started dating him, and after a year, we got married, and he was into a job with repairing TVs because he was going to Boston to take up electronics. And I thought, well, I got a man that's really into working. To make it short, it got after about 6 months into the routine of calling and saying the boss and I have to go out and work. We had a hard day. And, of course, I wanted to be a good wife. And I thought, well, what's wrong with him having a drink? Well, that one drink led into a year later where it was you could push a button. I'm going to be home later. And I kept everything inside because by then I had my first daughter, Debbie, and I didn't want to cause any confusion. I wanted to be the good wife, and I didn't want my daughter to hear fighting. But now, 4 years later, I had my other daughter, Lori. When Lori was 2 years old, from all these years of not making demands and saying, look, this is going to stop. This is not the way we should be living. I kept quiet. Well, by the time Lori was two and Debbie was four, he was really getting into coming home late. And as the years go, it takes time for them to get in blackouts. But I would say probably after about 8 or 9 years, he was coming home in blackouts. And when I look back at what I had put my children through, it's really should be an eye-opener for anybody who's listening. We have to stop protecting the alcoholic, whether it's a man or a woman. We have to protect our children. And when I wrote my books, it wasn't easy to admit that I failed in doing that. I will not say I'm the blame for Laurie to become an alcoholic and dying from it, but I will take the blame that her life might have been different if I had stepped away from it as soon as it started and said, look, I'm not putting these children through this. But I didn't do that. We don't realize as parents that things that happened to us in the past, we carry even to our marriage. To make it short, when I was younger, my mother was the type that if I wanted something, I'd go to explain, I wanted it. No, you not can't do it. But I don't want to hear it. So after a while, I didn't know how to stand up for myself. I'm not blaming my mother for my actions, but I think I didn't learn how to get out of that. So it was very hard for me to make demands on people. It was hard to make choices. So I think that added very much to the secret life that alcoholics live behind a closed door. And we try to keep it very silent. We don't want anybody to know that we're working with somebody who is abusing us. I'm lucky I lived. I had one time where he smashed my head into a chair, being upset, coming home late at night. Thank God that night my daughters weren't home. But to show how weak I was, I said nothing. And for 3 days I was on the couch and couldn't move. I know I had to have a concussion. One night he tried choking me in bed. You know, I even say these things out loud and I go, oh, my God. You know, how do we put up with this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't even look to reach out to my parents. And I found out after years, when Laurie left a boy that she was living with and was in love with, that he is abusing her. And that's the reason I wanted to leave, because I didn't want my children to go through that, but I let it go too long. So that's how my life really started, Randy, with the drinking and our family.
But, you know, I mean, to speak in your behalf, Alberta, this was not a topic that was talked about a lot in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, no.
You really were very much alone with this.
I made myself alone. I couldn't say that years ago. You know, in fact, I think that's the first time in my whole life that I ever said that. Wow, that's gross.
Wow.
We can use excuses. We have choices, just like the alcoholic. My daughter would say to me, Ma, how is God letting me go through this when Debbie isn't? Why doesn't Debbie have the disease? I says, Laurie, I'm a heart patient. I'm diabetic. Why don't my siblings have it? We have to face what we have and what we're going to do about it. And I said to Laurie, God gave you 3 chances, Laurie, trying to do something. You've been 3 rehabs. You've got to want from your heart to get better. And, boy, I'll tell you as a parent, it is so painful seeing your children going down that path and all your yelling and begging and screaming just is not reaching them. And prayers, believe me, I'm very spiritual. I'm in rosaries. I'm in novenas. I mean, and I didn't want to hate God when she died. I would never do that. I just know that I won't know the answers until he calls me home. Mm-hmm. But I do know that we all have choices. And she didn't, it was easier for her to go along with it. But, you know, when you talked in the beginning, got my attention when you were saying how the disease can start as an alcoholic being hereditary. And it's so true, because I look at 3 reasons why I think a person drinks or takes drugs. It's either it is hereditary, and I believe that from what I saw with my family, or, like, especially college kids, they want to follow the crowd, and they think I can give it up any time. But the third one, which I think is number one, really, is most drinkers and drug addicts have had something from the past very devastating that happened to them. They don't know what it was. They live in fear, because I found out after Laurie died, a counselor told me, she said she felt she always lived in fear. Believe me, those were hard times, hearing her fears because of what I put her through, too. It takes two. There's never anybody that's 100% right or 100% wrong in problems going in a family. It's how we're going to handle it. And that's why I named the book Someone Stop the Merry-Go-Round, because when we were in counseling, a counselor said, it's a merry-go-round you're all on, the drinker, the non-drinker, the children. Someone has to get off it. Someone has to stop it. And the way you do that is you've got to take a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
You either have to let the alcoholic go on his own and try and handle his problems, or you got to say, I got to do something different. But it took me 14 years to do that. And by then, the damage to my daughters had happened. And also, we're not to blame for the drinker, but we add to their addiction. Because if you demand it right in the beginning, as soon as you see that there's a problem with this drinking, that this isn't normal, this drinking is causing problems, then we should do something about it and stick to it. The worst thing I think the family does is we enable so much. We have this feeling like, if you do it one more time, I'm leaving you.
Mm-hmm.
If you do this one more time, I'm taking the kids off you. If you do this one more time, I'm calling the police. All they hear is one more time, but you're not doing anything. So you're only helping them to get into that addiction deeper and not telling your family, because my family loved him, and I didn't want them to know what was going on. But now when I think of it, I didn't want my daughters to live that way. So we're all affected mentally and physically living in an alcoholic family, and I had a small breakdown because I was pushing my body and my mind beyond what it could take, trying to control and change that person, and we can't do that.
No, we can't. I think one of the things that we do, I don't know if this is a message that that we get in society or whatever, but we think love can be enough to change somebody, that we can just love them. Maybe we haven't loved them enough. Maybe we need to love them more. Maybe we need to prove our love or show our love or whatever. And if we just love them the right way, they'll snap out of it. But love does not help an alcoholic or a drug addict.
You're right. So true. They say tough love with kids. We have to do the same thing with our husbands and wives that are drinking. And
Absolutely.
We don't realize when we're doing it, Randy, that we're actually giving them love. You know what I mean? But now I can see it. Back then I thought, oh, more, he's not going to think I love him. When meanwhile you do, and until that alcoholic dries out and can look at things with reality and look at take responsibility for their life and their actions, that's when they will start to see the love from the other person, but not until they dry out.
Right, right. And I agree with you that you can have all the genetics in the world or whatever, but if there's a deep-seated problem, and there generally is with every alcoholic, you know, if it's just a substance abuse issue and it is genetic, I think it's an easier thing for them to overcome once they finally wake up. But when there is this deep-seated pain, and my loved one, I always knew there was something that tortured him. I didn't know what it was, and he didn't know what it was. But he was never rehabs and whatever he did, you know. He just would always go right back to the drugs. So I think it's so important, you know, that is a component of their healing. But we do have to catch it early, because once it takes hold, it's that much harder to get to, you know, to stop.
Well, when Lori had passed away, my other daughter and I talked, and I never realized how much her father consumed her, because she had hinted about 8 months before she died, calling me after drinking, and she hinted that something happened with her and her father. And I said, are you saying something happened with your father? And she said, well, I know you know, Ma. I said, Lori, I don't know what you're talking about. So the only thing because she would never talk about it after that. So I think, now this is all guess because we don't know what another human being thinks, but I think that she either thought I knew and hated me for it, or she thought I just might not know and she didn't want to hurt me. And Lori put a lot of things deep down inside her. Like when I talk to the alcoholics, I tell them, they got to get that garbage out. If you don't get all your pain and your suffering out when you're talking to a counselor, it's going to stay buried and you're not going to heal. And that's what happened to Lori. And I think there was more that happened to this poor girl than I realized. And looking at her, I thought I had one of the most happy, go luckiest daughters walking this earth. And Debbie, I don't want to leave her out because she's my life too. I'm lucky she's 4 years older. She had problems late in life. Her marriage survived, but she never knew that it affected her because the oldest one, usually, from what I read in an alcoholic family, becomes the adult. She would hear Richie and I fighting, and she'd come out and say, Dad, leave Mom alone. And this is awful to say. We're talking about a 6, 7, 8-year-old girl. No child should be put in that position. That's when the mother or father should say, this has got to end, no matter how much I love them. Because people right off the bat think, oh, I got to divorce this person. You don't have to divorce them. Separate and work the problems out that way, because we slowly make our poor children suffer from the lives that we have. And when you look back, Richie suffered as a child with his mother and sister drinking after his father died. So it just trickles down from one member to the other. Somebody has got to stop it. But it's awful to put on the person not drinking because it's a heavy load. But in a way, it is our responsibility. We have to say something has got to be done about this. The one that's strong, because somebody that's in a blackout, they wake up the next day after he had smashed my head and couldn't understand why I was laying on the couch, and I knew he really meant it. He didn't know. That's when you realize a person is in a state where they can kill you. It's reality. We don't want to think it, because that always happens to somebody else. My God, he'd never do that to me. Well, you'd be surprised how the most gentle person in the world can change when they're in blackouts. And I just thank God that I lived through it. But I feel bad that Lori was the one that did a lot of suffering from it. Because let's face it, she was 2 years old when it started. And she loved her father. And then one minute he's loving and she's hearing him come in. And after she died, my daughter Debbie told me that Lori used to run into her room to feel safe. I never knew that. I mean, as a mother, that tears your heart out. You go, oh, my God, what did I do? So what I'm trying to say to people, if they're listening, you've got to make it stop. Stop that merry-go-round. Take all the love you have for your children and put that first. And I think if you can do that, you're helping yourself and you're helping the alcoholic. I don't care what the excuse is if you have to use it as the kids. But do that. And if you don't have children, I say get out of the atmosphere until it straightens out, or you can really, it just goes further. A push turns into a slap turns into a hit, or God forbid from there, can turn into a killing. So we have to take addiction and blackouts very serious. That's why it's important to do something before they get to that stage.
I remember, I was going to Nar-Anon, which is the Narcotics Anonymous for the spouses and families. And I was 7 months pregnant with a child, married to a drug addict, and trying so hard to work on this and trying so hard to do all the things that I needed to do to make my marriage work, And for anybody that's ever been to a 12-step program, when they're not supposed to give you advice. They just share. People share. But this woman, she was the chair of the meeting that night, and she went out on a limb, and she saved my life, and she saved that of my daughter, because she said to me, she said, Randy, for people, for me, I have a child who has addiction, and this is a life sentence for me. But you're married to this man. This is not. You can leave. You can get out of this. You don't have to stay in this marriage.
Yeah.
And it was like a light bulb went off. At first, I argued with her. Well, I married for better or for worse. And I argued with her, but she set this thought in my head that expanded and expanded and expanded, and it gave me permission to walk away. So, but the other thing is that I think that parents of young children don't understand how impressionable they are to the atmosphere. They think, oh, they're too young to understand what's going on.
Oh.
But they're not.
If somebody reads my last book that I never thought I was even going to write, with the 34 alcoholic and drug users, there are two people in there, women. One started at 5 years old and one started at 7. Mm-hmm. That's why I truly believe that schools should make it mandatory to have classes on addiction, because we think our kids don't know what's going on. But you know what the sin is, and I believe it happened to Lori. They don't know what's going on, but you're causing them to live in fear. Because every night, my poor kids waited and listened to Richie come in with his truck, and he had ladders on the top, and we could hear them clank, and you knew you held your breath, and what condition he was going to come in. That's a terrible way to live. And our children shouldn't be that way.
No, you know, children need to live in a safe, predictable environment.
In fact, I think Lori, being so young, might have blown things up worse, but I believe that a lot of them were true. Even though she went to counselors, and my husband Al and I are just talking about this. In fact, it was this week. It's funny. I think Lori needed to be more with a psychiatrist than with a counselor. And I don't like the way some rehabs have counselors with no degrees really going deep into the person's problems. And I don't think the 10 days staying at rehabs, it doesn't do a thing. To me, I almost laugh at it. And at that time, I wasn't allowed, and neither was Al, to go into counseling, or her own sister, for all of us to sit down. I think Lori needed somebody to tell her what happened. She was too young to absorb the difference between what wasn't happening and what was. So I have to take the blame for that. And that's what I'm trying to get across. If anybody's listening, if you're in control of that, do something about it. And I didn't. Even reaching out to a parent is helping. Something. Because once the drinker knows, family members know about it. Because I believe if my father ever knew, he would be at our doorstep. And that, I think, hurt my parents terribly when they found out at the end that we were getting a divorce. And they never even knew all this. My parents, to this day, God bless them, they died before my books. They didn't know the abuse I was going through. I think my father would have put me in the state hospital if he knew I was putting up with it. So it is.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say alcoholism. People have really got to look at it. It's not just a disease, but a dangerous disease. It affects you mentally and physically. Every single person, not just in the family. It could be a true friend who's close to you. It could be an aunt. It could be an uncle. You know, every person who knows that drinker or you, they're all affected by what's going on, and they feel just as helpless, because it ends up either the person putting up with it has to do something, or let the alcoholic go on their own and try and straighten out. And that's what we thought was going to happen to Lori. Let's face it, the AA comment, they have to reach rock bottom. Well, rock bottom for Richie and Lori was their death, because they didn't have the strength to pull themselves out of it. And talking about Al-Anon, AA, and Alateen, and I called the AA Center in New York and voiced my opinion that I believe they all help somebody. I'm not going to knock the the program, but I believe that once a month, AA should have an Al-Anon speaker, and Al-Anon should have an AA speaker. That's why I wrote What Is and What Isn't Working for the Alcoholic, because we have to learn what they're feeling and what they're suffering from. And we don't know that if we don't ask. And everybody goes to these meetings, and they close the doors, and when you come out, nobody talks about it. And that's not communicating. And if we can't communicate to our loved ones, we can't help each other. I mean, that's just my opinion, because I went 4 years in AA and walked out having almost a mental breakdown with everybody surrounding me, watching me taking the spit with yelling and screaming because my nerves just let go. So it all depends on the person, but I don't think anybody should get to the point that I got to. You were very smart, Randy, really, and just having something hit you in your heart, carrying that baby and saying, I'm not going to live like this. And that's how we all should do it.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it got dangerous. It started to get physically dangerous, you know, and I had to get her out of there. You know, one of the things that surprised me in the book is I think both your husband or ex-husband and daughter died of, was it cirrhosis of the liver?
Yes.
Okay. And I've heard about cirrhosis of the liver, but I never understood what a horrendous death that is.
Oh,
can
yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about that?
Well, you know, when I saw Laurie, because I can't really get into it because I know we don't have much time, but if people read Someone Stopped a Merry-Go-Round, they will realize what I went through with Richie, but Richie and I divorced near the end of the book, and I didn't really see all his signs like I did with Laurie, and I wasn't allowed to go to Richie's in the hospital to see him. Again, a long story. People would have to read the book to understand it. But when I went the day Laurie was brought by ambulance, there wasn't, Randy, I swear, there wasn't a part of that girl's body that wasn't gold, her skin, not yellow. Oh. It was such a deep gold. Her stomach was swollen while she was pregnant, and all I thought about was Richie. And she had IVs all in her, all over, legs, arms. And she had the tubes in her nose like her father, from what I heard. And what's even worse for the alcoholic is they see one tube in their nose and the other one, the blood is coming out because your veins in your body are breaking. And Laurie was rushed to the hospital because she was hemorrhaging from her rectum, and she thought it was hemorrhoids. But I think deep down she might have known. I can only guess because my daughter never talked about it. But that's what happens. And then to see them go into a coma, and when I went in to see Laurie, I got a call at the hospital. She was hemorrhaging. They were rushing her up because they were trying to put tiny elastic bands around her veins and her esophagus. And you can do that for so long. But when I went in to visit her after we were all grouped as a family in the waiting room, no one warned me that she was on life support. I expected to go in and see my daughter sick, but I could talk to her. Well, that blow. And you're sitting there and you're listening to just the sound of the machine breathing for her. In 3 weeks, it's up and down. She's going to live. No, she's not going to live. You know, well, the last week she was on the life support. And when a doctor tells you if your daughter's organs have all shut down, the only thing keeping her alive is the machine. And if you don't take her off the machine, something's going to go wrong in her body and she might have a heart attack. Well, that reality was so overwhelming that we had to push wanting to keep her alive for us. That's what you wanted. You don't want to let go of them. So it was a very hard decision to sit there and watch them take the machine off her because, you know, it was such a useless death. If only they would reach out for the help. And you wonder why. That's why I wrote What Is and What Isn't Working for the Alcoholic and Addict. Don't get me wrong. I hope people buy the other two books. One is about Richie's life. One is about Laurie's. But this last book is written by the alcoholic and the drug addict. And it's not just talking to one addict to another. They're talking to parents, siblings, telling them how you're enabling. So it's really a family book. So that's what I'm really hoping people buy the book for.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I read that. Yes, yes. It is amazing to hear from the source. I mean, exactly what is working and what is not working for them. Very, very valuable book. I mean, everybody has somebody that they know that goes through this. It's epidemic. And it's so, and I'm so sorry about what you went through, Alberta, but you ended up finding a very, very wonderful man, and your life changed.
Yeah.
I know you lost your daughter, and that's a forever pain. But you did find somebody who was very wonderful, and I think your life has changed.
Well, believe me, it scared me enough. We joke about it. Al and I dated 10 years before we got married. I was very scared to reach out. I had my own home. He had his home. I had my home in North Dighton. People probably never heard of North Dighton. But, and that's how I wanted it, because I'm not sure. Isn't that funny, Randy? 10 years, you're not sure. But it got to a point where I decided, both of us, what are we doing? We're not young. You know what I mean? Either I said to him, I don't want you knocking on my door with a cane. I said, are we going anywhere with this? So finally, that's how we got married. He was afraid I'd want a big wedding. I said, are you serious? I said, we're both married. I said, because his first wife got killed in a car accident, and she was in her 30s. So he was just scared to remarry, too. So that's what I mean. Everybody is affected in so many ways with their lives. But if you don't communicate, if you don't talk, problems don't get fixed.
No, that is very, very true. That's very true. I mean, I'm a huge proponent in that, which is why I do the show, because I want all of it out there, in every possible way. I want people to be aware, because that's the first step toward healing any situation. We are coming down to the end, Alberta, but I wanted you to just talk about, if you're doing any tours or any meetings, or about your books a little bit, whatever I haven't brought up. Can you just share that with us?
Well, I do talks if someone calls me for the alcoholics and drug users. I go to halfway homes. I go to the rehabs. I go to court audit programs. If somebody, whether it's in a church group or, let's face it, businesses, you can talk all over, I'm willing to do that. And I always tell people, I just talk from the heart, because I'm not a counselor, I'm not a professional, and I let everybody know that from the beginning, because I don't like to tell someone how to handle something. I'll tell you my experience. But I'm really proud of the books that I wrote. If somebody bought, all my books are in paperback and Kindle on Amazon. And if you can't remember, if you just key my name and all my books fall on the bottom and you can see them. But to write Someone Stopped the Merry-Go-Round about my life at Richie, I had to get permission. It took me a year to get permission from his family to write about it, because they own Lopes Construction in Taunton, which is a big construction company, and they didn't want people to know. It took a year. And then I never thought I'd be writing a book on a sequel of losing Laurie, because I was going to write the sequel and name the book Laurie, and I was going to have her tell me what her feelings were, what she was suffering from. And I never got to that point. In fact, I wish she had lived long enough to read about her father's life, because it might have answered a lot of her questions. But she died before I wrote that book. And that's why it was so important for me to get what isn't working for the alcoholic and addict, because I couldn't get the answers from my loved ones, what they needed. What do the alcoholics need from us to help them? And the reason I got 34 stories is Laurie was in Butler Hospital, and she said, I listened to a man 70. I have no idea what he said, what he was doing, how he lived. And that's when I realized I needed a lot of stories, because we all live different lives, but somebody out of the 34 should be able to say, that's my life. That's me.
I agree.
So that's why I took so many. Yeah.
I thought that was a brilliant approach to understanding alcoholism and addiction, because it's really, it's all pretty much the same.
So what I'm doing now, my last step is I'm just writing my first fictional, The Rusty Years. I want people to see a lighter side of me. Alberta Sequeira is done with memoirs. They're very painful to write.
Alberta, spell your last name, please.
Sure, it's Sequeira. S is in Sam. E Q U E I R A. Sequeira.
Okay. Okay, and I'm looking at your page here, and I spelled it wrong, so I have to fix that. But and do you have a website?
Yes. One for the alcoholics. I have two of them. One for the alcoholics is albertasequeira.wordpress.com. And the one that I have for authors and writers is just albertasequeira.org.
Okay, perfect. And I to my listeners, I want you to know that Alberta had no writing skills prior to doing this. She had no writing education. She really never wrote before. And when you read these books, you will think she is such a seasoned writer. And I compliment you that again on that, Alberta, because I'm a writer. I can recognize a good writer. You are a very, very good writer.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us. It's priceless. And what you're doing to help other people is so remarkable. And just keep doing it, because this is never going to stop.
But, no, it isn't.
But awareness is the number one way that we can get this under some control.
I agree. We have to talk openly about it. And I'd like to give my email address to Randy. It's alberta.sequeira@gmail.com. And anybody who wants to write me, I love to hear from people. My husband always says, you don't write email notes. He says, you end up writing novels to people.
I think I do the same.
Yes. I want to thank you very much, Randy, for having me, and I hope that the both of us have given a voice to the addicted. I really do.
Oh, I do believe we have. Thank you so much. I so appreciate it, and I hope you have a wonderful day. I hear you're thawing out up there in Massachusetts, so
yes,
spring
snow
is coming.
Melting.
The crocuses will be popping up.
Well, thank you very much, and I thank you all the listeners also.
Okay. Well, have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Thank you. You too, Randy. Bye.
Okay, goodbye. So unfortunately, our time is up for today. That was a very powerful show. So if you have any comments about today's show or any other shows for that matter, please email me at loveyourlife@randygfine.com. Randy is RANDIGFINE.com. And my website is also randygfine.com. Sign the guest book. And I welcome feedback about my shows, so you can leave comments for me there as well. If you enjoy listening to my shows, it would be great if you become a show follower. When you become a show follower, you'll get notified of all the shows. Right now, I've scheduled into May. Every one of my shows is important, and I have fantastic shows coming up as well. So you'll be notified of that. So please become a show follower. There's a follow button, I believe, on each show page, and you can just click on that, and you'll become a follower of my shows. All my shows are archived after broadcasting, can be listened to at your convenience on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, or through the show links on my website. Thanks again for tuning in and listening to A Fine Time for Healing. This is Talk Radio show host and author Randy Fine, signing off until next time. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about Randy at her website, Randy G. Fine. RANDIGFINE.com. Join her next time for more of A Fine Time for Healing.
Hard not to hesitate, but we can't wait to be the change. there's a better way.